from Simon & Schuster Audio. The Big Show, Inside ESPN Sports Center. Written and read by Keith Olbermann and Dan Patrick.
Warm greetings and welcome to the Big Show audiobook. Alongside my tag team partner, Keith Olbermann, I'm merely Dan Patrick.
You're right about that merely part, and right at the outset here, I think we should mention, for those who might not connect a voice with a face, Dan is the one who sounds like Hal the Computer from 2001 if he just rolled a home run on Hank Aaron's Stratomatic card.
Keith has the raspy throat of someone coming off a night trying to drink with an entire NHL team. Let's just stop that here. We have a very important question we have to answer right away. People keep asking us, Dan and Keith, barometers of the sports world you may be, stars of television and radio, sure, but what are you doing writing a book? What exactly is the Big Show book going to be about?
It's going to be about 9 inches high by about 4 inches wide by about 200 pages long with an audio program of about 180 minutes. That's what we tell them. That's what the hell it's going to be about. Then we explain that we placed 9th in TV Guide's list of the top 10 performers in all of television for 1995, and all the other guys on the list had already written a book. Seinfeld, Oprah, Marcia Clark. We felt it was our turn to rake in some easy cash. I mean, John Tesh has even written some music.
Well, sort of.
Right, sort of. Anyway, we thought we could convey our take on the world of sports, pass along the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff of what goes into the making of our show, tell our dreams and hopes and favorite ABBA songs.
And how I invented the word gone. People are always asking us where all these catchphrases come from. You know, gone for a home run, the whiff, and fuego, nothing but the bottom of the net, all the other good ones. And then, of course, the ones Keith uses, too, the ones he usually steals from other people, usually me.
That's right. You invented everything, the whole English language. Glenn, give me a break. In ABBA's mega hit Dancing Queen, there's that moment when these two great singing legends pause for a moment, and then you're gone. And as old as you are, Dan, I believe that song came out even before your brilliant career began.
Mm-hmm.
So what if they were repeating sounds they had learned phonetically? They still said, gone. Nothing is new. Nothing in sportscasting. Nothing in Swedish disco music.
What is wrong with you? Where did all this ABBA stuff come from? We're supposed to be explaining the show. We're supposed to be talking about all the ball players we know, how I got to know Bill Murray. Instead, it's micro details from the career of ABBA. What's next? 99 Luftballons? Have you lost your mind entirely?
Well, we have now been working together for 5 years.
Could we possibly get this back on track? This is an attempt to translate the idea that every night we go out there and have fun with the world of sports. We show the highlights and tell the news, of course, but we're enjoying what we're presenting. And, of course, we're doing it almost completely ad-libbed, and we're seeing the highlights just as you're seeing them. And sure, we have an attitude. We criticize the bad trends and the show-offs and the greedy players and the greedy owners. But we're there to have fun. And that's what I tell them the book's going to be all about.
Of course, by this point, they've either walked away or taken a swing at one of us.
Yeah, usually me.
Well, you look guiltier.
I do look guiltier. The number of times you say something really stupid on the show about a player or somebody, and then I run into that player or somebody at a game or somewhere else, and then I get blamed for it. Remember that thing with Bob Knight when you showed him grabbing one of his players by the shirt and you said, at home with the Knight family? Real good. Very clever, Keith. I see him on the road and think he's going to put a chair through my thorax.
Well, you know, it's not like you always defend me or anything in those situations, bub. When you went up to Eric Lindros of the Flyers at the ESPYs and told him he should come over and threaten to kick my ass, I mean, what was the idea there, Dan? If he hit me, I would have been drooling the drool of regret out of my ear instead of out of my mouth. And anyway, pal, it backfired on you. We wound up buddies.
Oh, we won't hear about that in the pages to come, will we? It'll be Eric Lindros this, Eric Lindros that, my new best friend Eric Lindros, and blah, 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 blah.
And it'll be coming soon, dear friends. Anyway, jealousy does not become you, Dan. As ABBA sang...
Enough with the ABBA, all right? We've got a book to start here, and you're babbling on about four singers nobody remembers anymore. Meanwhile, everyone out there is going to get the impression that we hate each other.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Keith and I have been friends since we worked together years ago at CNN. I was even at his going-away party. Keith gave me some very good advice on my career, and to repay him, I've carried him professionally since he joined me on The Big Show.
Oh, now I get it, Dan. This is a fictional account of the program. Well, all right, let's get started, whatever it is, shall we? But one thing first, Dan.
And that is?
You need some more rouge.
Oh, yeah, original. We'll start with a sort of glossary of terms, those catchphrases everyone questions us about.
Apparently, we live in a time now when the catchphrase is America's primary form of communication. And evidently, Dan and I are something of a catchphrase factory, to the point that our stupid little sayings are spat back at us, and I mean that, at ball games, by fans and players alike. For instance, at the 1995 Super Bowl, Dan was riding the Chargers team hotel elevator when the doors open and Natron Means and a couple of his teammates stepped in.
And then Means says, "Hey, Dan Patrick, how you doing? I'm Natron Means." So I say, "Nice to meet you. Good luck Sunday." And then Means says, "Man, can you say that thing you say?" "Huh? That thing you say?" So I ask him what he's talking about. So Means says, you know that thing you always say?" Another one of the Chargers starts to get annoyed. "Come on, the phrase, your thing." "Which one?" "The one that begins with N. Come on." "Nothing but the bottom of the net." And Means is now getting annoyed. And then he says, no. Fuego.
We will spare you the other stories. Very frequent, very similar. Pick up a paper and every 2 months or so, you'll read somebody talking about how they can't hope to stop such and such. They can only hope to contain them.
And one of us, we won't say which one, but Keith, the single guy, was actually asked by a date at a critical moment to say one specific catchphrase from way downtown. Bang.
Yeah. The thing has gotten so out of hand over the years that a viewer named Mark Cole, who actually has turned watching the show into an academic pursuit at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, presented a scholarly paper on the metatextual viewing of ESPN's SportsCenter at the Midwest Popular Culture Association Conference in Indianapolis in 1995. As the comedians Bob and Ray used to say when people would read a message into their humor, "They left here fine. Something must have happened to it when it got to the transmitter." Truth be told, our catchphrases, and we were shocked to discover that there are 76 of them still more or less regularly in use, have a true practical value. Remember, we're usually ad-libbing the narration of these highlights. There's nothing better than a trusty old catchphrase, or a rusty old catchphrase, to kill off a second or two while giving your brain the chance to say something, anything, that might actually be insightful. Well, enough analysis. Here's a handful of these metatextual delvings into symbiotic baggage and electronic shadow memory. A good craftsman never blames his tools.
This is Keith, for use when a player breaks his bat, throws his bat, slams a stick or a racket or otherwise, well, blames his tool. He heard this somewhere, but he can't remember where. A likely story. And a mighty roar went up from the crowd.
Used to describe players or fans who do not seem as happy as they should be following a home run, touchdown, or victory, often accompanied by Dan making a faint,
"Yay!"
sound. A paraphrase, again, of a Bob and Ray sketch in which a promoter explains his plans to play team backgammon in the Yale Bowl using refrigerators as dice.
Big Show.
I started calling it the Big Show within a week or two of joining Dan in 1992, and interestingly, this had a very off-putting effect on some of our colleagues who thought we were implying that the 11 o'clock show was big and the other editions of SportsCenter weren't big. In fact, we were just comparing the hour that we put on to the half hour that CNN Sports put on. Considering that everybody from David Letterman to Ed Sullivan has called his show the Big Show, we have no flipping idea how this actually stuck, but it did. And you bought something titled it, didn't you?
Biscuit in the Basket. As in, he put the biscuit in the basket.
Used for hockey goals, and with the increased advent of soccer highlights, used for soccer goals. A simple steal from a Canadian show in which some announcer used the phrase to describe some junior league player scoring a goal. It also spawned such mutant catchphrases as, "If you don't bake the biscuit, you can't put the biscuit in the basket," which can be used to describe a hockey team that does not take enough shots on goal. Another one. Brought to you by...
Also from hockey, to describe a pass leading to a goal, or to list the assist credited after a goal's been scored. The original is from CBS, whose voiceover announcer for commercial sponsorships was a famous New York disc jockey named Roscoe. Our pal Bill Pito became so enamored of Roscoe's gravelly voice and elongated delivery, he would march around the newsroom, adding a little southern twang to it, saying, "Brought to you by ITT and by Pennzoil." Typical to Keith's ethics, he stole it. Detlef Schrempf.
Now, as Dan just showed you, you have to punch yourself in a tender region as you say that NBA player's last name, and you'll be able to pull off a reasonably good impression of Dan saying it. There's no mystery here. Dan likes Detlef. Dan's constant use of it led to a friendship with the gifted German player. They actually dined together during the 1996 NBA Finals, during which Detlef and his Seattle teammates also experienced that phenomenon of being punched in a tender region. Here's another one. drooling the drool of regret into the pillow of remorse.
Used typically while we're showing you the graphics scoreboard panel to make a comment on a losing team or a player who did not perform up to par. It was created specifically to get a laugh out of Keith's buddy, Rebecca Lobo, the basketball player, who told him she had turned several shades of red after she and roommate Pam Weber were shown in a photo in People magazine brushing their teeth, and a tiny little bit of drool was seen at the corners of each of their mouths. En fuego.
As Mr. Mean's annoyance suggested, probably the most famous example of Big Show phraseology and the one Dan most regrets not having trademarked earlier. And I mean that. This is actually a twice revised version of one of the oldest of sports cliches, namely that a player is on fire. Dan simply got tired of hearing it, tired of saying it, and was complaining, typically, about it. One of the cameramen offhandedly suggested maybe he should try it in Spanish. So Dan modified it to, for instance, Detlef Schrempf is absolutely el fuego. Well, a high school Spanish teacher from Pennsylvania wrote in not long after that, noting that Dan was not saying Detlef Schrempf is on fire, but that Detlef Schrempf is the fire. She offered the correct version. En fuego promptly wound up on t-shirts and bumper stickers and hats and as a special insert series for Pinnacle baseball cards. Dan at least got his own card out of that one, standing there in suit and tie with a bat on his shoulder and a very grumpy, dissatisfied look on his face. Here's another one. Gah!
Very simple. The gagging sound, originally implying nothing less than an athlete having choked, more recently broadened to describe any error, flub, collision, or otherwise untoward on-field incident. Golf.
That's golf. Dan sometimes adds the explanation that what you just saw was a golf shot. G-O-F-F. Became particularly confusing when catcher Jerry Goff returned to the majors with the Pirates in 1993. In turn, golf shots, nothing but golf shots, is used in clips promoting upcoming highlights of golf tournaments, usually from the PGA, the Pro Golfers Association. I introduced this to tweak Dan's nose a little on the subject of golf, and also to pay homage to David Letterman's use of the 1980s New York radio station promotional slogan, Love Songs, Nothing But Love Songs.
Happy, happy, joy, joy.
Used for narrating celebrations, direct ripoff from the cartoon Ren and Stimpy. Former Big Show producer Mike McQuaid claims he suggested it. Mike also claims the European PGA Tour is interesting.
He beat him like a rented goalie.
The phrase used to describe a goal after the biscuit phrase has been used too many times, which is usually. A simple parroting of the colorful, sometimes bizarre radio announcer of the Pittsburgh Penguins, Mike Lang, whose goal-scoring call is, he beat him like a rented mule, which may in turn be borrowed from the comedian Jeff Altman's bit about his father when he's angry. Try this one. He's day-to-day, we're all day-to-day.
The Big Show version of this most cliched of medical reports about injured players, day-to-day originated in the 1970s, and of course it was Keith using his version of it on a college radio station late that decade.
Oh, yeah.
The Associated Press ran a story about NASCAR driver Dale Jarrett back in 1995 in which it quoted him as saying, I decided I needed to make a move one night when I was watching SportsCenter on ESPN. The newscaster, I think it was Keith Olbermann, was talking about some baseball player and said his situation was day-to-day. I thought to myself, really, aren't we all in a day-to-day situation?
You got that right, Dale. Here's another. I can read his lips, and he is not praying.
Used during tight shots of athletes swearing, mostly to take the edge off the obvious profanity for all you lip readers, a direct quote from a rather eloquent New York cabbie who in 1983, with Keith as a passenger, cut off another motorist, there's a shock, turned to look at his vanquished driving foe and intoned the memorable phrase,
I can read his lips and he's not praying. Now try this one. I can't believe I shook this guy's friggin' hand.
For narration of the highlights of hockey's longstanding tradition of the team shaking hands at the conclusion of a Stanley Cup playoff series or after any shown handshake, this is a direct quote from Dino Ciccarelli of the Detroit Red Wings referring to Colorado Avalanche captain Claude Lemieux after the latter messed up the face of Detroit's Chris Draper during the 1996 Stanley Cup Finals. One of the all-time great sports soundbites.
I can't believe I shook this guy's friggin' hand. If you're scoring at home, or even if you're alone.
Follows a baseball double play or other events featuring many players tossing the ball around. And homage to the legendary Dodger announcer Vin Scully, who would often give the exact sequence of fielders on such a play for the benefit of any listener who was, in fact, keeping score at home. Keith added the licentious part. Vin has far too much class and elan to have ever thought of it, let alone say it.
It's deep, and I don't think it's playable.
One of the many home run calls, and another theft at that, I said it around the office. Keith said it on the air. I threatened to break Keith's clavicle if he kept doing it. Keith modifies it sometimes to insert my name by way of giving me credit. It's deep, Dan, and I don't think it's playable. Sometimes further modified to describe a great catch as in, but Kenny Lofton does. Nothing but the bottom of the cup.
For an unusually long golf putt, or better still, a hole-in-one, as in the next one.
Nothing but the bottom of the net.
Another inimitable call for a three-pointer or a long two-point shot in the NBA. Several variants around the sports world, foremost of which is nothing but net. My favorite is nothing but the bottom of the standings, which is used for a team which hits the basement, especially if Dan has just used either cup or net. Now here's a new one. Organization.
Keith picked it up from listening to one too many hockey players speak of his team, his franchise, his organization. Canadian emigres working for ESPN do not find this funny at all, and nearly all of them say it is a provincial dialect native to one of the provinces they're not from. Related phrases including referring to the confluence of the ice and the sideboard as the dasher, a uniform as a sweater, or an arena as a building.
E.g., our organization was hurt when Gretzky ripped his sweater on the dasher in our own building. That's for Alanis Morissette's pain.
For use whenever a goal is scored against the Toronto Maple Leafs, or when the Leafs lose, the Canadian songstress' first hit, You Should Know, about a disgusting, abusive boyfriend, was allegedly inspired by her relationship with a Maple Leaf player. We'll never identify the player. The phrase may, however, be adjusted because Toronto apparently traded him away. The whiff.
Another one of the few A-pluses of catchphrasedom used for strikeouts in baseball, swinging only. The origins are in the backyard of Dan's beatific childhood home in beautiful Mason, Ohio. Dan says he said it every time he'd strike out one of his brothers as they played wiffle ball. They say they said it every time they'd strike him out. I have on occasion used the phrase during tennis matches or hockey games, or once when a skunk was seen running around the outfield in Jack Murphy Stadium in San Diego. The whiff. And here's another one. With authority.
Usually used to describe a slam dunk, purloined from Larry Beal's impression of Marv Albert's slam dunk call, often modified to the point of giddiness. In one show, we transformed this into without authority, with port authority, without any authority, by whose authority? By the authority invested in me, and with Brad Doherty. And then we told Larry we were sorry.
Sorry, Larry. We're still sorry, Larry.
You can't stop him. You can only hope to contain him. For the purpose of expressing respect bordering on fear for an unlikely hero in any sport, when Benny DiStefano of the Houston Astros legged out a game-winning triple in 1992, he, of course, had a total of 25 extra base hits in his five-year big league career, I paid tribute to him by adapting this old football analyst cliched observation. Of course, in a newspaper the next week, Keith got credit for the line, which is the story of my life.
Mm-hmm. There are numerous other wonder phrases, obscure references, and knickknacks with which we have clouded your brain over the years. We will save them for appropriate times in certain stories.
That out of the way, we'll get started.
First, a timeline history of the Big Show.
April 1st, 1954, Ithaca, New York, becomes the first large community to establish its own cable system. No Ithaca, no ESPN. Keith later attends Cornell University in Ithaca, spending most of his time cutting class and watching cable.
May 15th, 1956, Patty Patrick of Zanesville, Ohio, tells her husband Jack that her labor has begun. Jack, busy watching a Cleveland Indians game on the television, calls her an alarmist. An hour later, Daniel Patrick is nearly delivered in the family car. May 15th, 1958. For second birthday, Dan receives 35-inch Rocky Colavito model baseball bat. Indians, learning of gift, begin negotiations to trade Colavito in 1960 and ruin franchise for next three decades.
That's a little harsh. January 27, 1959, Keith Theodore Obermann, born in New York City, to startled and consistently head-shaking parents.
January 21, 1963, Detlef Schrempf is born somewhere in Germany. If this event does not occur, Dan's catchphrase becomes, Dwayne Schitzes! History changes.
January 15, 1972, Keith is published for the first time. His article, An Appreciation of Cocoa Puffs Cereal Harlem Globetrotters Basketball Cards, appears in a trade magazine, The Trader Speaks. As payment, Keith receives a warm note of thanks from the editor-publisher, Dan Dishley. November 4, 1973, Mike Ehrenstein of TCMA privately publishes Keith's first book, The Major League Coaches, 1921 through 1973. The first press run is 100 copies. Mike still has several if you're interested.
Closer to 100, actually. August 7th, 1974. Eastern Kentucky University wins the basketball recruiting war for Dan. September 1st, 1974. Dan arrives at Eastern Kentucky University. Coach Bob Mulkey observes Dan's long hair, dubs him Golden Boy, advises him he'll have best seat in the house for EKU games.
He wasn't lying. October 7th, 1975, scheduled to observe sports shift at WVBR-FM, Cornell freshman Keith discovers he is actually doing that night's sportscast. Keith's soul leaves his body for the following 4 hours. He mispronounces his own name on the air twice.
December 11th, 1977, Dan informs parents he needs, quote, greater educational challenge, unquote, and wants to transfer to the University of Dayton. Dan neglects to inform them that his two older brothers, attending school, have told him Dayton is top party school in America. January 14, 1978, Dan's broadcasting career begins as disc jockey at WVUD, the campus station at Dayton. First song he plays, Why Don't We Get Drunk and Screw by Jimmy Buffett. FCC begins pursuit of Dan, case still considered open.
September 15, 1980, Sports Illustrated publishes brief feature on Keith's radio work. Issue sells out in metropolitan New York. On the same day, Keith's savings mysteriously drop from $1,786.42 to $9.42. August 3, 1981, Keith makes CNN debut as fill-in for New York reporter Debbie Segura. First interview is with Mets manager Joe Torre. Anchorman Nick Charles, not recognizing Keith, looks into camera with great alarm. March 26, 1984, Keith's last week begins at CNN Sports.
My replacement as New York and national sports correspondent arrives from Atlanta, same date, Dan Patrick.
March 30th, 1984, at Keith's going away party at Greenwich Village Bar that night, he advises me, and I agree with him.
June 14th, 1984. Doing feature piece on out-of-town reporters covering NBA Finals, I interview Dan. Dan says he works for Cable News Network. I say, what's that?
May 11th, 1985, Keith's first feature article for a major periodical appears in the early editions of Sunday's New York Times.
May 12th, 1985, CNN news writer Susan White accepts Dan's invitation for their first date. She remarks to a friend, he's the guy who wrote that wonderful article in the Times today.
She did not. September 2nd, 1985, Keith debuts at KTLA-TV. December 26, 1986, Los Angeles Herald Examiner names Keith its choice as best local sportscaster. Los Angeles Times names Keith its choice as worst local sportscaster. Keith is confused.
Confusion continues. August 29, 1987, Dan and Susan White are married in New York. December 19, 1987, Dexter Manley of Washington Redskins picks nose during interview with Dan. Dan asks him to stop. Dexter replies by wiping his fingers on Dan's pants leg. Dan laughs nervously.
February 3, 1988, Keith notifies ESPN he will decline to join staff as SportsCenter anchor. Panicky, ESPN executives ask, maybe we can get that CNN guy who had Dexter Manley's snot on his leg. December 16, 1991, Keith announces he will leave KCBS to join ESPN. Cable cancellations hit an all-time high. January 4th, 1992, Keith, Chuck Wilson, and Tony Bruno sign on ESPN Radio Network. A week later, Keith is talked into giving up a two-month vacation to Hawaii to stay in Connecticut to continue to help launch Network. National Society of Psychoanalysts convene special convention to analyze.
April 5th, 1992, I debut with Dan on the 11 p.m. Eastern Time SportsCenter.
I'd still get misty-eyed thinking about it. April 6, 1992, Keith, exhausted, accidentally verbalizes his thoughts on the length of the program. Damn, Dan, this is one, you know, big show. January 24, 1995, Connecticut basketball star Rebecca Lobo tells Fort Lauderdale newspaper that her dream job is to co-host Big Show with Keith. Keith faints and tries to fire me.
Close.
October 1st, 1995, Keith and I are both nominated for Cable Ace Award as top sports host. Keith will win. I will present him with a trophy. Keith will require 17 stitches.
February 14th, 1996, we are approached, quote, about a book. I remember I checked out Notes on Moby Dick from Hackley School Library in 1974 and never returned it.
September 10th, 1996, Keith nominated for third time for Cable Ace Award as top sports host, selects Jack Kemp as running mate. Neither will win.
September 29th, 1996, Mike McQuaid concludes 3 years stint as producer of The Big Show, during which time he has gone from age 28 to age 71. McQuaid is immediately elevated to sainthood by the Roman Catholic Church. Gus Ramsey is dragged kicking and screaming to succeed St. McHugh.
Which brings us to today. You listen to this, you need to get out more often.
You know, the old joke about sausage goes, if you like them, don't ever go to a sausage factory.
We're not making any self-deprecating comparisons here, but if you've ever thought of us as smooth, unflappable, or infinitely well-prepared under no circumstances...
I just went...
Oh, you snickered?
Putting in a sound effect there.
Oh.
Infinitely well-prepared got me laughing.
Oh, okay. We're not making any self-deprecating comparisons here, but if you've ever thought of us as smooth, unflappable, or infinitely well-prepared, under no circumstances should you come to the studio and watch us actually do the show. The show itself is conducted amid a chorus of voices in the studio and in the control room, with 1,000 last-minute decisions being made and chaos threatening to escape its reins at almost every minute.
Well put. Of course, that's only the last hour of our day, the show itself. The rest of the stuff is pretty sedate. We often like to explain the job thusly. It is just like yours, with all the hassles, the headaches, and the meetings, only the last hour is on national television. Perhaps the easiest way to convey how The Big Show gets on the air every night is to take you through a kind of chronology of a typical day.
3:30 p.m., we start the ideas meeting. During the meeting, we'll learn what pre-taped features are running that night, called pieces, knock-around ideas for the breakdown segment or other pieces written particularly for the show, home-cook pieces, discuss what order we'll do the highlights, selecting the lead, and generally get the dozen or so staff up to speed.
You could probably figure out the lead story on any given night. I mean, we're trying to guess which story you'll be most interested in, or which Sunday NFL game deserves a feature piece from a reporter on the scene. The pieces are usually selected well in advance by minds far greater than our own. Well, management anyway. And many of them are regularly slotted for a particular day.
Often it happens that a comment or a joke or an observation one day will be the wellspring for a great piece the next. Remember the mock serious breakdown on mascot injuries? For days, meetings were filled with staffers simply recalling weird pieces of videotape they had seen involving mascots. A week later, we had a 2-minute feature, one later nominated for a National Sports Emmy.
Nominated, not winning one. Some meetings are epics, though. We walked into one in 1995 on the day Mickey Mantle died. Management had concluded that The Big Show that night should open with reaction from baseball figures to Mantle's death, followed by several segments of game highlights, followed by the official 8-minute-long Mantle obituary piece, followed by more highlights, followed by a special Sunday conversation made up of Roy Firestone's various interviews with Mickey Mantle.
And we disagreed. How could we go back and forth to the passing of this legendary, almost mythical figure? We each knew we weren't going to be doing any jokes that night, or any catchphrases for that matter. We argued successfully that the entire segment of the show before the first commercials should be devoted to Mickey Mantle. The reaction, the obituary, the Yankees game that day, we shouldn't go near the other highlights until after the first break. And most importantly, we impressed upon the staff that we had to treat this one show as somberly and reverently as if we were a religious network covering the funeral of a pope.
Anyway, this meeting is usually done by 4 o'clock. The show rundown is then fed into the computer with the exact order of the stories and a list of what each story will consist of. Options include on-camera segments, videotaped highlights, comments from athletes or sports figures, etc. We now return to our desks and we begin to write The Big Show.
This remains the biggest surprise to most viewers, many athletes for that matter, and even some people in the media. Other than occasional feature pieces written by an associate producer and then mildly tweaked by one of us, we write the entire show, ourselves. If you don't write your own material, what are you really bringing to your own sportscast? How can you even call it your sportscast? Your average beady-eyed news anchor person is reading stuff somebody else wrote.
It just is not that way at ESPN. Never has been, likely never will be. The greatest advantage to writing your own scripts is the defense it provides you against chaos. When the teleprompter fails or the story changes at the last minute, if you're relying on something somebody else wrote, you may have no idea what to say next. Well, between what we write and all the other sundry stuff we write for the computer or the radio networks, we write 10,000, 15,000 words per week each. That's the equivalent of a book every 6 weeks.
At 4 o'clock, the deadline of the show still seems far away, and we tend to use the 4 to 5 o'clock hour to make phone calls, some of them on stories, some of them not, well, actually, it's none of your business what we do with those other phone calls. However, infrequently, journalism is actually required in sports. We are reporters. If we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, we won't know enough to write an intelligent script about a story, let alone make a joke about it. We still view whatever acclaim we've gotten as an unlikely gift that could all go away tomorrow, and probably will. But we get very pompously proud of the news stories we've broken on SportsCenter, 100 or more, big and small, in the 5 years we've worked together.
And 5 to 6 o'clock is the hour when most of the information is sought or arrives. This is the time when the unlikely tips come in from people we may know well or we may not know at all, like the occasion when one of our top anonymous sources phoned in to say a Major League Baseball manager had just been fired. We asked how he was sure. He explained he was calling from the guy's office in the clubhouse and all his stuff was in boxes and he just said goodbye to all his players. But that's not the wildest tip we've ever gotten. The day after the verdict in the Rodney King case in Los Angeles, our top source called to explain that the L.A. Kings had decided to fire their coach, Tom Webster. Solid enough for a good story, but there was more. In the middle of the meeting to make the change, somebody noticed smoke rising from a neighborhood near the Kings' offices at the Forum. The L.A. riots were underway. The meeting, our source explained, was suddenly adjourned. A vice president said, "Let's get the hell out of here." And as everybody scurried for the door, they confirmed they were letting Webster go, but they postponed announcing it until after the riot ended. That's the way we reported it, and that's the way it happened.
We don't just get a call from somebody and then slap something onto the air. If one of us has a source story, we run it past our senior management, and rare is the occasion that we don't have to go back to the phones and get a second or even a third source to confirm what the original one had said in the first place.
The most fun on a source story comes when everybody gets involved. The chronology of our report last November that Lou Holtz was quitting at Notre Dame went as follows, with a few of the details left out to protect the innocent or the somewhat innocent. Tuesday at 8 p.m., Dan gets a tip that Holtz has met with his bosses the night before and requested a multi-year contract. They've said no, he's said goodbye. Dan makes 18 phone calls, can't confirm it.
Wednesday, 12:15 a.m., I tell Keith about Holtz. Keith asks why he hasn't said anything earlier. I say, well, what's your name again? Keith starts making calls. Wednesday, 2:30 p.m., a source with terrific connections to Notre Dame, its board of trustees, and its athletic department tells Keith that whether or not it's over the length of the contract, Holtz is leaving at season's end.
Wednesday, 3:30 p.m., Chris Fowler calls in with a tip that Holtz has told his assistants that there is a 90% chance he won't return in 1997.
Wednesday, 9:50 p.m., Keith's source calls back with more details, and Keith writes up a story that something's going on for the ESPNNet Sports Zone, computer service, and ESPN Radio. Thursday, 12:15 a.m., a Notre Dame football player, cruising the Internet, stumbles across Keith Holtz's story. By morning, every player on the team has heard about the column.
You betcha. Thursday, 11 a.m., Holtz tells the assistant coaches to begin notifying players of a 4:30 p.m. special meeting. Thursday at 4:30 p.m., in a series of meetings, Holtz tells his players he's leaving after the 1996 season. Notre Dame running back Randy Kinder, asked afterwards if Holtz is resigning, tells a Chicago newspaper man, "I'm getting all my ideas from Olbermann on SportsCenter."
And that's scary, but correct. Thursday, 6:30 p.m., the Holtz may leave story runs on SportsCenter for the first time on the 6:30 Eastern edition.
Thursday, 11 p.m., Dick Vitale calls in to say a basketball coach has come up to him at a banquet and told him that Holtz has told a friend of his that he's resigning.
Friday, 10 a.m., a source very close to the coach calls Keith at home and tells him, yep, he's gone, it's done, and they've already called Gary Barnett. Keith records a commentary for ESPN Radio to run that afternoon that Holtz will officially resign within the week and Barnett will be Notre Dame's first target, the first national media report that the coach is out.
Tuesday, 1 p.m., Holtz announces he is resigning. Tuesday, 5 p.m., Barnett announces he's been approached by Notre Dame.
Thursday, 5 p.m., at the moment the story crosses the wire that Barnett will stay at Northwestern, Keith's source calls to say it'll be Bob Davey. Tom Clements is still being mentioned, but it will be Davey.
Thursday, 11 p.m., SportsCenter reports that Notre Dame defensive coordinator Bob Davey is expected to be named the school's new head coach within the week.
Thursday, 11:45 p.m., during the show, Keith's source leaves a message. I double-checked. It's Davey. Thursday, 11:57 p.m., Keith's bulletin saying Notre Dame will offer the job to Davey crosses ESPNNet.
Sunday, 12 noon, Bob Davie is named the coach at Notre Dame. So how do you mark that one down if you're scoring at home or even if you're alone? Patrick to Olbermann to Fowler to Olbermann to Vitale to Olbermann.
Summing it up, that 4 to 5 o'clock hour can be a lot more important than it looks. Or we can spend it with our feet up calling all of our old friends from college.
As of 5 o'clock, if we haven't started writing, we'd better. Into the computer we go, and we're confronted with a 66-page shot list with numbers and abbreviations outlining the story's page number, the type of shot to be used, who's responsible for writing and reading the page in question, the story title, we call it a slug, the tape machine number, and what's actually supposed to happen at that particular moment. This could be a two-shot where we're both on camera, an on-camera lead into the highlights, or something like the scoreboard that follows the highlights. This gives you a rough idea of just how precise this 66-page list is. It isn't just Dan and Keith breeze through the day's highlights and news, and we haven't even gotten into what research and writing has to happen to make sense of an unknown abbreviated insert.
So the writing goes on all night. We've literally written whole new lead stories at 10:59 for an 11 o'clock show. We've written stories as late as 11:58 for a show that's going off the air at the stroke of midnight.
At about 6 p.m., we eat.
Yay!
This usually involves eating at our desks while we write or make more calls.
7:30, we start watching games out of the corners of our eyes. You want the worst possible job in terms of getting to sit around and watch a ball game from national anthem to final whistle or out. We have to pay a little attention to almost every single game being televised. The record for the number of different game highlights shown in a single one-hour big show is 27. We didn't get to see every minute of every one of those games.
8:30, production starts on the tease. That's the minute of assorted stuff you see before we come on and say hello. About this time, we've also recorded narrations to special features we're doing that night, breakdown, peak performers, whatever.
10 o'clock, we begin thinking about makeup. Actually, I've been thinking about it most of the day. And then we start getting dressed for the show. Only at this point do the dress shirts, ties, and jackets come on. Then, it's makeup. It used to be just what you saw in the most renowned of the SportsCenter commercials in the tiny men's room just off the newsroom. In the summer of 1995, that changed. We are now professionally painted.
10:45, final touch-ups to the script. Late scoreboards can be written here. Readjustments to lead-ins if games have gone in directions other than what we've earlier guessed. Wholesale changes often have to be made if the producer has changed the rundown to place breaking news stories higher in the show or replace outdated ones, or he's just decided to mess with us.
10:55, we head to the studio. This is a comfortable 3-minute walk. It can be done in 90 seconds when necessary.
11 o'clock, time to make the donuts. Basically, from here on in, it's a roller coaster that never rides the same course twice. Sometimes the tease didn't get edited in time. The teleprompter doesn't work. The shot sheet makes it in time, but the tape doesn't. There's a late change in the story one of us is about to read next. Our building is hit by lightning, and we're still on the air, and the highlights are still rolling, only we can't see them, which actually happened once.
12 o'clock. Any night of the week except Sunday. We say our final stupid somethings and then go home. On Sunday, however, the show will be repeated at 2 a.m. Eastern, and then again every hour from 6 a.m. until 1 p.m. Monday afternoon. Very often, we have to correct technical glitches or incorrect information for the re-airs. We always have to record new final segments indicating what's next at 2:59 a.m. or 12:59 p.m. This process, the dreaded fixes, can take 5 minutes or 95 minutes. Legendary is the time that the New York Rangers agreed to let Coach Mike Keenan go to the St. Louis Blues at about 12:45 a.m. Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
One of us had already gotten home and had to come back to the studio. We won't tell you which one, but he consequently hates Mike Keenan and says, biscuit in the basket a lot.
We could go on and on about the process. It is maddening, fascinating, and very rewarding, and we've both long felt that its complexity contributes in great part to why we sometimes seem to be so goofy on the show. We're punch drunk, especially when there have been problems.
We tried hard. We honestly do. The goal every night is perfection. Nonetheless, on live television for an hour every night, 4 or 5 nights a week, pushing 50 weeks a year, sometimes things don't go quite the way we want them to.
For the record, that workload amounts to around 8 24-hour days. No wonder you look so old.
I have 4 kids.
You only have 3 kids.
You make 4.
Rim shot, please.
Everybody screws up. We just wanted to share some of the wilder moments when bad things happen to good sportscasters. For whatever reason, we can certainly fall apart by ourselves without anybody else's help. Remember the "you're a handsome man," Mr. Gelson?
Dan got me started during some White Sox highlights. You just couldn't say the word mound, and we both started laughing to begin with. And then there was a shot in the same highlights of a really overweight guy sitting there in 49-degree weather.
And then I say, lots of jokes come to mind here, but I want to keep my job.
So I say, there's your darn mound.
And I start laughing. I just can't speak for a couple of seconds. I decide, well, what the heck. Remember the movie JFK when Kevin Bacon says to Kevin Costner in this terrible southern accent, you're a fine-looking man, Mr. Galson. So I said, or at least a version of it, you're a handsome man.
And I lose it. There are tears in my eyes. I am laughing so hard. And I've got to come back on camera and do a lead into a piece Tommy Jackson did on the Chargers trying to fire themselves up to play the Broncos. And in it, I have quoted Sean Jefferson saying, we've got to keep saying we have to kill them. Kill, kill, kill.
So Keith collapses completely. He is laughing and coughing and trying to read this quote. It's like, kill, ha, 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 kill, ha, 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 kill. And then finally he just says, never mind, never mind. Here's Tom Jackson with something.
We've had lots of those moments where it's like Mary Tyler Moore laughing during the funeral of Chuckles the Clown. You weren't there for the worst one.
No, no, I wasn't. The disc one?
Yeah, the dreaded bulging disc. It was a Monday night, Dan's off, and Steve Levy is filling in for him. Steve is very smooth on the air. Now, the Big Show gets very low ratings until the Monday night football game ends. When we hear Al and Dan and Giff start to thank their producers, we know the audience is beginning to tune over to us. Sometimes the viewers will multiply by a factor of 30 or 40. So we try to get the commercials, the features, and the whatnot out of the way early in the show so that when these viewers join us, we can give them the big news of the day and maybe go back to the game for a live interview or something. This one night, the game's winding down, and we're just cleaning up the last of the filler items. Steve's going to do the football injury report from the weekend's games, and I'm going to do a basketball highlight. Then I'm going to do the Monday night football highlights. No commercials, no breaks, no pre-recorded packages.
In other words, no way out.
Exactly. So Steve's reading this story about Maurice Hurst, a defensive back who is now suing the Patriots because they cut him while he was hurt with a neck injury. So Steve's doing fine, just finishing up his on-camera about Hurst, and he's preparing to read a long narration of a videotape full of other injuries from the weekend. That's when it happens. He's supposed to say, Hurst has been suffering from a bulging disc in his neck.
Only he didn't say disc.
Switch a few letters around, and you can figure it out for yourself what he said instead. Well, there's a second or two delay before he realizes it. By the time this happens, the injury tape has started to play. Me, I'm laughing so hard it sounds like I'm getting sick to my stomach. Steve is talking about guys with broken femurs and lacerated chins and hyperextended knees, and he's laughing a little bit, and his delivery is a little disjointed, but he is the calmest guy in the building. The camera people are laughing so hard, the cameras are shaking. Now I'm thinking, I've got to follow this. I've got to come back on camera in about 30 seconds, as soon as this injury tape ends, and I'm just going to lose it. And in my mind, I'm hearing Dan saying, you're a handsome man. What the heck, I'm going to humiliate myself anyway. I might as well make a final joke before I fall apart completely in front of all those people who are just tuning in from Monday Night Football. So just as the tape ends, Steve pauses for a moment, and I say real loud, thank goodness we didn't have any videotape of that Hurst injury. Mean remark. But why not? He's finished. I'm the one who's going to be on camera now with tears streaming down my cheeks. Problem was, he wasn't finished yet. There was still a graphic coming up listing all the other injuries. I'd forgotten about that part. So now poor Steve starts laughing, and I made him do it. Sure enough, though, he collects himself, manages to read the first two or three injuries, and then he comes across a guy who has a strained groin. And this time he just collapses in laughter. Well, I'm really in trouble. I'm definitely coming back on camera in about 10 seconds, and my eyes are so full of tears, I can't see the teleprompter. That's when it dawns on me. If I take my glasses off, and I just read the basketball lead-in off the script page, at least I won't be able to see Steve laughing or anybody else falling apart. So I take them off and hold the script up halfway to my face and start reading it.
Now, I'm not working, and I tune into the show for some odd reason at this time. And I'm watching, and I see Keith, he's not wearing his glasses. I see, what's going on? He looks terrible. His eyes are watery. What happened? Is he sick?
Not in the way you thought, Bunky. Somehow we got through this. Longest 5 or 6 minutes of my life. And it kind of worked out okay in the end, too, Dan. I mean, I think Steve got a couple of dates out of it.